Fred began by talking about an hors d'oeuvre and a main course. There is such a thing as a main course and afters. I leave you to decide which of us has done which. I think I am very particularly happy to be here tonight giving the other half of this ensemble, as it were, of talking about my father and his books here at a meeting of the Evangelical Library. The Evangelical Library meant so much to him. Probably most of you friends who were with him over the years in the Evangelical Library, people like Mr. Micklewright and all the rest of you, you knew this. You knew how much he loved the work of the Evangelical Library, how much he loved working first with Mr. Williams and then with Mr. Sayer. This whole idea of this great library full of Christian books, this great heritage and treasure of ours, it meant so much to him. We were talking earlier about numbers of members. I think he could never quite understand why there weren't thousands and thousands of people all cramming in for membership and all taking out hundreds of books all the time. It was a work that he felt was a great work of God. And I know he himself counted it a tremendous privilege to be involved in it. It all began in such an extraordinary way, how he came across Mr. Williams through a mutual friend of theirs, a chemist somewhere in North London, who brought these two men together. And from that moment on, here was the work of the Evangelical Library. And I think it's peculiarly fitting, perhaps, that we're talking about his books here tonight. Now, it's a very difficult thing for me to do, really. To start with, the title says, Him and His Books. Well, I think we found some difficulty in deciding on a title. And I think perhaps I will be forgiven if I broaden the spectrum slightly. By the way, I'm not coming here to talk about all the volumes on Romans and Ephesians. Somebody once said to me when they knew I was going to do this, they said, why are you doing that? Because Ian Murray did it so magnificently in the Thanksgiving service anyhow. Well, I'm not going to talk like Ian. Ian was talking about him and his books. This really is about him and his reading. Now, it's a great subject, this. And I'm very aware that as I start on it, I can see a lot of you here. Friends of his from the early Evangelical Library days, as I say, ministers, his sons in the faith in the Westminster meeting, the fraternal, the Westminster Conference, you all know so much about him and his love of books. And I'm perfectly certain that probably as time goes on, you're going to say, my goodness, she hasn't mentioned that, or I don't agree with her about that. Quite likely. I can really only deal with this personally. And if I leave anything out, or if I don't put the emphasis that you wanted, please forgive me. I can only do it, as I say, as I myself saw him. Well now, personally, if I'm to be quite honest, I think I must say that on a very human, personal level, I miss him along the whole line of reading, almost more than any other way. A lot of my friends who had lost those dear to them said, it's funny, you know, it's the little things that bring back your loss to you. And I'd heard them and I'd understood the kind of thing they meant. But I must say that one of the most shattering experiences I had really was after the great mixture of sadness and of glory, really, of the funeral service and of the Thanksgiving service here in the chapel. This sense we had that he had gone to be with the Lord in glory, that his weakness was now over. And I remember about a few weeks later, I was in the public library, and I was looking along the biography shelves. And I had recently been reading the lives of all that remarkable family of Bensons, Archbishop Benson, and his able sons, the man who wrote for Punch and E.F. Benson and all the rest of them. I'd been reading them. And suddenly along the bookshelves, I saw a book called Bishop King of Lincoln. Ah, I thought, now he must have been around about the same period as Archbishop Benson, who had also at some point been at Lincoln. And I thought, when I get home, I must ask my... And I realized I couldn't ask him. And it was then I realized this great loss I was suffering, this great reader, this friend of mine in reading, he wasn't there anymore to talk about it. And you see, I knew perfectly well. I mean, how many of us have heard of Bishop King? Not many of us, I'm sure. But he would have known about Bishop King. He would have known where he came from, where he went to, what his relationship with Benson was, where they disagreed, how evangelical he was, all these things. And he's not there anymore to answer these questions. And I still find, and I'm perfectly certain that I'm speaking here for Anne as much as for myself, that so often when one finds a new writer, there are some not new in themselves, but new to me, I still miss this. I was put, and I'm very grateful for this, onto that remarkable little book, The Force of Truth by Thomas Scott. John Marshall said to me, have you read it? And I hadn't. And I found it and I read it, and it was a most remarkable book. I discovered J.G. Philpott, the old Baptist preacher, and I have enjoyed him very much indeed. I've been discovering about Vicar Pritchard of Wales, all these people that I didn't know about before. Somehow the edge of the enjoyment goes off, because I can't go to my father and say, now what about these? What about Philpott? What was his influence exactly? How about Thomas Scott? Isn't it remarkable the way that he wrote this book and so on? And so I do miss him along this line, because as I say, it was a line along which I peculiarly appreciated him and all that he had to give. Fred has given this picture already of his sitting in this armchair. We've got a photograph of him in the family. It's my favorite of all the photographs. Some of you may have seen it. I can't remember if it was in any of the magazines. It was, that's right, of him in profile, reading. And that is exactly how I think of him. This oasis of peace in the middle of all the life that was going on around us, this peaceful man sitting there with a book on his knee, enjoying it and wanting us to enjoy it as well. Now, my early memories right back are connected with him and reading. I remember quite well in the study in Aberavon, my mother must have been out or something, sitting in his study, as I say, which was lined with books from floor to ceiling, over the floor as well often, on the desk, theology everywhere. And here I was sitting, I must have been, well, I certainly wasn't at school, sitting on his knee while he very seriously read to me from The Littlest One, his book. Now, I don't know how many of you know it. It's a book of poems, an enchanting book of the 20s and 30s of poems for children. And I remember him very earnestly discussing the characters of Jane and Emily Jane with me, why Emily Jane was so much nicer than Jane, and what it was about Jane that wasn't pleasant. He was perfectly prepared on reading to come down, as it were, to this level. It was something that he enjoyed doing. And, of course, he himself, I know, has said, and here again, when I reread what he had to say in Preaching and Preachers, I felt, well, really, what am I going to say that he hasn't already said? But perhaps I'm really only underlining some of the things he said. But he said how always on holiday, he would always read a great deal. And this takes me back to another early memory. I remember going to stay in Borth. I was, again, very young. It was the mid-1930s on that lovely sandy beach in Borth. It was a boiling hot summer day. I know we always tend to think it was boiling hot when we were children. But this really was a boiling hot day, and I was gambling about in a bathing costume and digging and paddling and all the rest of it. Everybody else was on the beach in the amount of undress that was allowed in the mid-1930s. We were all hot, and there we all were with this glorious sunshine, all sunbathing, as I say, and playing. In a rock, in front of a rock, over to one corner of the beach, fully clothed, in a grey suit, with a hat upon his head, his usual hat, shoes, socks, the whole thing, waistcoat, sitting bold upright, as I say, leaning back against a rock and reading The Divine Imperative. And this was on a sunbathing beach. You see, he read like this. He read always, as I say, in the mornings and the summer holidays. He read all the time. But the great thing about it was that we never resented this. Anne and I took this as part of him. He was the great reader. It was his work. It was his enjoyment. It was part of him, and so it became a part of us. We never resented it. In fact, it's interesting. My mother has a story, I don't remember this myself, of apparently in my first term at school, it was the time of the great unemployment in Aberavon at the time, and a lot of people, of course, were out of work then. And every child in the reception class apparently was asked what work their father did. Nobody knew about this. It was something that apparently landed on us in an ad hoc sort of way. The first thing that my parents knew was that I came back from school weeping copious tears of indignation. And when they tried to find out what was wrong, apparently what had happened was this amiable but ill-advised teacher had asked each child in the class what work their father did. She'd gone right round the class. And of course this was to find out how much unemployment there was in the class. Now, as I say, the girl was ill-advised because she happened to know what my father was. He was the minister of the chapel down the road from the school, so she knew. She didn't bother to ask me. I came back filled with indignation. My father worked terribly hard all day reading, and nobody had mentioned that he worked at all. So you see, there it was. Reading was to him something that we knew. Yes, he preached, but he read. And he read lovingly, regularly, and a lot. Well, now then, as I talk about this reading of his, perhaps I just better fill you in a little with the background. I won't be long here. He came from a family that was always interested in reading. His father was not a very well-educated man, but he was a man who was interested in the whole world around him. He read the papers carefully and methodically. He read one or two religious papers as well. He kept himself in touch with the world around him. My father's older brother, who died in the flu epidemic in 1918, was also a great reader who not only read but also wrote poetry. We don't know what the poetry itself was like. We've got one or two little exercise books of rather charming First World War type poems. He knew apparently Robert Graves and Siegfried Sassoon, so it's interesting. He was in that kind of literary background, this older brother. Tragically, as I say, he died. His younger brother also was a literary figure. He went to Oxford, and there he knew Ronald Knox. He met Evelyn Waugh. He has got a considerable amount of fame over the past weeks with this Brideshead Revisited, because he'd actually met Evelyn Waugh and knew him. Not well, but he had at least come into contact with him. And even more interestingly, my uncle was actually in the same tutorial group as C.S. Lewis. So you see, they were a reading family. There was this kind of talk about books and authors and writers and how you wrote and so on. So there it was. Well, then as we look at him as a reader, to come on to how he handled his reading, I wouldn't be true to his tradition, would I, if I didn't start with the negative. Remember, he told us we must always start with the negative. So I shall start with the negative. He disliked paperbacks very much indeed. Now, all of us in the family, grandchildren, children, everybody, we all had to persuade him that books were very expensive nowadays. The students, of course, as you can imagine, were very ferocious about this. How could they afford to buy books costing £10.95 and so on? And he did grudgingly agree that perhaps this was true. But you see, it's interesting why he disliked these paperbacks. Books to him were friends that you kept for life. And you see, you couldn't keep these paperbacks, they fall apart. If you just bend them open, then they're finished, aren't they? He did have a kind of grudging allowance of these halfway house books. I can't remember what they're called. You know, they're sort of stiff paperbacks. Them, perhaps, he could tolerate. But by and large, he did not like the paperback world in which he now found himself and was, I think, never quite happy that one or two of his own books came out in paperback, though, as I say, he allowed it for expense sake. Now, the other thing that's interesting, of course, and one tended to forget this about him, he didn't like digests at all. He said at one point, "I am not a believer in digests and encyclopedias. They encourage a ready reckoner mentality rather than thought." But when you think about it, of course, this is very typical of him. He couldn't bear anything potted, as it were. He didn't like shortened versions of things. He didn't like biographies, which were just a few broad sweeps of facts. He liked the biography to start about 200 years before the subject was born and work up to it. You know, he liked his book to be full books. He didn't like this modern habit of thinking that you've got a lot of knowledge if you just knew a few headings and so on. Digests and encyclopedias, no way for him. I must say, the Reader's Digest did go in and out of the house, but very rarely would you find him looking at it. And I'll be coming back to this potted dislike of potted things later on. And interestingly enough, too, arising out of this in a way, the third thing he disliked was an over-concentration, now I must underline, an over-concentration on style for its own sake. Now, of course, he liked his books to be well-written. I mean, he liked all books to be well-written. He himself enjoyed a good style. What he was worried about was that if the style took over, as it were, from the contents, if they were mannered, books that he couldn't bear them. He had a very interesting passage you may remember in Preaching and Preachers, where he says that he thinks that this was part of the cause of the downfall of the pulpit and preaching. I don't know if you remember this place. Was that, you see, preachers had begun producing beautifully styled essays instead of preaching the word. It was interesting, too, with regard to style, how sometimes he really disliked something that was quite beautiful in style because the content was wrong. I remember having quite a discussion with him about Tennyson's poem Crossing the Bar. I don't know how many of you know it. Sunset and evening star, one clear call for me, and may there be no moaning of the bar when I put out to sea. And I thought this was the most beautiful poetry. He said, but it's wrong, he said. It's wrong. The truth is, safe into the haven guide. Oh, receive my soul at last. Christians don't go out to sea when they die. They come into the haven. And I said, but it is beautiful, isn't it? He said, the beauty doesn't matter. It's wrong. So you see, this is the point. It was style you had to be very careful of. And here, of course, I've got to mention the whole question of style in his own books. I mean now, the things his Ephesians, Romans, and all the rest of them. My goodness, he did have some problem with his editors. Especially, I remember one day, right at the very beginning, one of the very first books he brought out, the very earnest editor, it was a very early book, very earnest editor sent him back his manuscript covered in alterations, you know, nevertheless instead of but, or although instead of something else, and on it would go, or an adjective instead of a noun, or in the margin, don't you think there are too many adverbs in this line? My father almost threw the manuscript at me and said, cross it all out, he said. Put it back in the original and leave it alone. And it was interesting, towards the end, he said to me, when you come to do the editing of the books, he said, don't agonize too much over the words. Now, he was perfectly prepared for anything that was repetitive or, you know, where he'd already said it, or at the beginning, for instance, you know, he didn't want the same thing repeated over again. He didn't mind these first paragraphs and so on. But this desperate fuss about the exact word all the time. Don't worry about it, he said. This is the truth of God. Let the truth go out. And I must say, it's very interesting how many people have said to all of us in the family, it's great reading his books. We can hear him as we read it. And that's the point. This is what it was the content that mattered. This was the thing on which you concentrated. Of course, you made the content as nice as you could for people to understand it, but you didn't fuss and fiddle on about the style. So that style. Then the other thing that he was really not keen on, he didn't enjoy novels. Now, I must make this quite clear. He didn't disapprove of novels. He didn't object, really, to other people reading them within moderation, as with everything else, though I think he did sometimes feel that too much novel reading was a waste of time. But he himself didn't enjoy them. He actively disliked Dickens and Hardy. Depressing men, he used to say. Dickens, I think, probably because of the intense assault on the emotions that Dickens keeps on doing. You know, he keeps on twanging on your heartstrings. Everybody dies by inches, and they're always little girls, and all this kind of thing. I don't think he could take this. And then Hardy, with his cynical pessimism, he disliked them. And as I say, novels in general he didn't enjoy, but there was one great exception, and that was Sir Walter Scott. Now, Sir Walter Scott, he really had enjoyed tremendously. As I say, he didn't. Time was at a premium when in his ministerial life, and I don't remember him reading him much. But Scott was a novelist whom he loved. And the funny thing about him was, of course, that the bit that the rest of us always skip, the first 100 pages of every Scott novel. That was the bit he liked best, you see. You see, it's this non-potted thing again. Here was Scott building up his background. He loved it. Also, I always think, as far as I myself am concerned, it's interesting how perspicacious he was as a lover of literature. It always worries me, as an ex-English teacher, how they often start children off with Scott with Quentin Durward or Ivanhoe. Far and away the most boring thing Scott ever wrote. Now, my father started me off with Scott with The Antiquary, a great novel, and Old Mortality, another one. Heart of Midlothian, all these, they were the ones he got me onto first. Scott at his greatest, really. So his whole approach to Scott was interesting, and as I say, really very perspicacious. So Scott really was all right as far as novels were concerned. Now that really also leads me on to say that he was very fair about novels. I haven't mentioned one thing. He was very good. He would often put us in touch with perhaps writers we hadn't heard of. I'll be coming on to this more just a little later on, but it was he, for instance, who began me off on John Buchan. Interesting, he during the war, produced a few copies of Buchan and said, I think you'll enjoy this. But I think probably Buchan again, because he's in a sort of Scott mould, in a way. It's this kind of novelist he liked. But there was one lesson, I think, that he always taught us. And that was, and here I come on to something else that he felt strongly against in reading. And that was that reading must never become like a drug. Fred has memories of his talking about people who are always wandering about with their noses in books. I always have an uncomfortable feeling that he may have been referring to, well, perhaps to me, perhaps to Anne, perhaps to both of us, I don't know at that time. There was a time I remember quite well when I'd evolved a system whereby you could dress and undress while reading a book at the same time. Now, this kind of thing, I think, worried him a little. In other words, reading can very quickly become a drug. I think that was why perhaps he had slight reservations about novels as well. One must never allow reading to sort of drug one. One must never allow it to take control of one. The Christian reader is to be in control of his reading as well as of everything else. So that was a danger. The other thing too, and he makes a very clear point of this, that never, never should one read just to impress other people. He says, I have emphasized the place and value of reading, but if your chief reason for reading is to parade it and make a display of your knowledge, it is obviously bad in every sense. Now, he was talking largely about ministers there, but I think he meant all of us as well. He was always worried when somebody would become famous in the world of whatever it was, and you'd get Christians rushing to get hold of it, just to get a smattering of knowledge about him in order to say, I have read so-and-so. Now, this always concerned him. You don't read in order to show how well-read you are. You read, as we'll go on to see, for much more important and profound reasons. And the other thing that he felt very strongly was that you never read just to get ideas which you then regurgitated. He said, we are not meant to be gramophone records or tape recording machines. I remember sometimes his expressing some anxiety about various speakers who, because of their love for the writers of the 17th, 18th, 19th century, would produce the thoughts of the 17th, 18th, 19th century, and often in the language of the 17th, 18th, 19th century. In other words, a kind of regurgitation of your reading was what he didn't like. He used to worry sometimes about a person who we'd say, goodness, isn't he able? Yes, he'd say. But I think that what he is just a good student. Now, this didn't mean that he didn't want people to work on, to concentrate on their work, but not just somebody who read things and could reproduce them. Reading was much more than that, he said. Much more than that. And here I go on to perhaps one of his most significant statements about reading, and now I am moving on to the positive. He said, in a sense, one should not go to books for ideas. The business of books is to make one think. The function of reading is to stimulate us in general, to stimulate us to think and to think for ourselves. Take all you read, he said, and masticate it thoroughly. It's rather like bacon, isn't it? You know, about books that are meant to be not some swallowed, etc., etc., but some are meant to be chewed and digested. That was the reading that my father approved of. You chewed and you digested your books so that they became part of you. You were then stimulated. You thought. And what came out was your, as it were, quintessence of all the reading, but it was yours. It wasn't originality for originality's sake. That was not what he meant. You took all this wisdom of all the ages and you made them a part of you. You were stimulated. So you thought better, and as a result, you spoke better. So then, coming on to his reading himself, what were the marks of his reading? Well, you may be surprised at this, but he was not a quick reader. I'm sure most people thought that he got through books at the speed of knots. He didn't. He wished he could. My mother said that he often said, you know, there are so many books to be read, I wish I could read more quickly. But he was basically a slow reader. He once apparently sent away an answer to some advertisement for a book that told you how to read more quickly. One of these books that tells you just to look at the middle of the page and all the other words will float into it and it'll be all right. But in the end, he came back to his own method of reading. And he read in his own way. He read a lot, yes, but he didn't read it quickly. But of course, the great thing about him was his phenomenal, and I use the word advisedly, I think, memory. He remembered what he read. And I think he remembered what he read because of these things that I've talked about before. Because he concentrated on the contents and this, what I can not think of putting it in a better way, mastication principle. Because he read in this way, then he remembered it all. It's interesting, as Fred has referred to his knowledge of the New Testament. He was not at all a rote learner. He couldn't learn by heart. He actually couldn't learn by heart. To sit him down with a four-line verse and say, now learn that, he couldn't do it. But if he was preaching and he would begin on a passage in Paul, a verse would come to his mind, he would often go through about 15 verses without stopping, absolutely correctly in the authorized version. Because he knew it. The contents had mastered him, and so it came into his mind. So the slowness of the reading didn't matter. He contained all that he read. May I say, incidentally, it's quite interesting on this knowledge of the Bible, though she would, I think, be very annoyed if she knew I was saying this, my mother, I think, probably could hold a candle to him in the Old Testament. He would often have to turn to her over some of the stories, and if he wanted to know the names of the three daughters of Job, for instance, mother would know them, the three of them. This kind of thing often, she had a good sense, she has a good sense of the Old Testament stories, and he would often turn to her and say, now, where does that story about whatever it was come? But on the New Testament, the epistles of Paul, he was matchless. Now, with regard to his reading himself, his general reading, I think the amazing thing really was the breadth of his reading, the extent of it. And as I say, this is what is so difficult really to know even how to begin to handle. He was a very wide reader indeed. Fred has mentioned some of it, and really I can only underline some of the ways in which he read. He said at one point, he had been asked, obviously, about the chief function of reading. I've said about the stimulus, that was the main thing. But he then went on and said, what then is the main function of reading? It is to provide information. Now, he read widely for information, and it was interesting how important this was in so many fields. For instance, the Westminster conferences. I'm sure we all remember, don't we? He'd finish, wouldn't he, have the last lecture, and he'd have his subject. You know, how he'd read it all, how he'd got all these facts, how he chaired all these meetings, and he knew all the speakers' facts as well as they did, often, sometimes a little better. I remember once in the very early days, his reminding the speaker of something that he hadn't actually put in his own lecture. He read widely for information of that kind. He also read for information in other ways, and this is where I often think that he has, certainly as far as I myself am concerned, a lot to teach. He read for information on very basic things, and here we have a very interesting story in our immediate family. Our elder son had to have a series of eye operations. And at one point, my father was away, and Christopher began producing some very unpleasant, frightening symptoms. And the doctors were completely baffled by them. It was almost like that bit in Christopher Robin, you know, all sorts and conditions of famous physicians almost came hurrying round at a run. But certainly they were called in, these strange, distressing symptoms that this boy had. And they began to discuss what it was. Was it something psychiatric? Was it this and that, and nobody knew what it was. In the end, they were going to send him to a series of specialists. At this point, my father came back from his holidays. Came back to find us all very anxious about him. And he said, well, now tell me about this medical system, wasn't it really? And we told him the whole story. And he said, the next time you take him to the outpatients, I'm coming up with you. So Christopher and I went up to the outpatients. My father came with us. And of course, it's great. The old boy network amongst doctors is terrific. Doctors can always go in and say, well, I'm a doctor here and this is fine. So they let him in. And he asked the young houseman, I suppose it was, if he could see Christopher's notes. And as I say, imagine one of us asking to see the notes. You know what happens in hospitals if you ask to see anything, your temperature chart or anything. However, here was this old doctor who could, well, he couldn't do any harm with the notes, so they handed him Christopher's notes. And he sat while Christopher was being seen and everything, and there was considerable conversation going on, going through the notes, carefully and accurately. And the consultation was over. He made notes. That's another thing, by the way. He said you should never read without having a notepad at your side and a pencil, so that anything you read, anything that struck you, you could write it down. So he went through the notes carefully. He didn't say anything. He came home, got out the notes, and he then went. Now, the doctors, if there's any doctor here, they'll know what I mean. There's a huge book of medicines, a great big sort of thing telling you every medicine that is made. It's brought out afresh every year. He went to this book. He always had one of these. He looked it up, and he found that at a certain point, Christopher had been given a certain drug. He found out about the drug in his compendium of medicines, whatever it's called, and read there the side effects of the drug. In other words, he had read the information. In other words, you see, instead of just talking about things and airing theories, may I say, his winged words about the current state of some young doctors were marvelous to hear afterwards. But you see, he read. He never put forward theories and great ideas on things that could be a matter of fact. He always made certain that he knew his fact, and so he read them. And of course, once we had discovered about this medicine, it was passed back to the doctors, who all had to agree, yes, of course, this was the reason, and everything was perfectly all right, and the symptoms went. So, facts. But more than this, again, telling you a family story, our younger son, as many teenagers do, at one point flirted dangerously with transcendental meditation. And was talking endlessly about it, of course, and discussing it with everybody, and saying he'd been reading these marvelous books that were going to set the world right, and it was all great from the standpoint of 15 years old. So my father said, well, now, what are these books? This is the great thing about grandparents, isn't it? They have time to talk. And so Jonathan produced the book by the guru, a man called Lobsang Rampa. I always have to think, I have a tendency to say Lapsang Soochong, which is a kind of tea. But it actually was Lobsang Rampa. And my father said, I'll take that book, I'll read it, he said. So he took the book with him and went off preaching in Manchester, actually in the Free Trade Hall. And they had a great service on this particular evening. And as he came home in the train that evening, he thought he would read Jonathan's book. And he read it from cover to cover. He did say that he had a slightly uncomfortable feeling. The book was a little paperback with a picture of a sort of Chinese face. The book was called, may I tell you, The Third Eye. And in the Chinese face, there was an eye in the middle like that. A most bizarre-looking cover, hideous, with this eye glaring out from the cover. He did have a slightly uncomfortable feeling that the people who had heard him preach in the Free Trade Hall, if one of them was sitting opposite him, would wonder quite what was going on. However, he read it. He read it with care. He read it seriously. He took notes on it. And when he came back, he went through it with Jonathan. In other words, the tendency so often, isn't it, with young ones is to say, oh, but goodness sake, that's all rubbish. You forget about trans, and that's nothing. You grow out of that. Not at all. He wanted to know just exactly what it was that was getting hold of this boy. And he went through, he He said where the points were good, but he pointed out where they were dangerous. And because he had read it, he knew the book far better than Jonathan did. And as a result, the information that he had acquired made him able to deal with this kind of situation. And I'm sure you could all multiply these stories in so many other occasions. This reading for information. Then, of course, and here, I, as I say, I can only just say it in general, he read widely and he read generally. He read biography, again, detailed, rich biographies, and of a very interesting variety. He, for instance, had greatly enjoyed reading a biography of that great, brilliant, and tragic figure of the 19th century, Cardinal Newman. This whole story of where he'd gone wrong and how it had happened and what this great mind, how it worked and so on, the whole way the Catholic mind worked, he'd read that. I remember, too, once Fred and I had to go to a luncheon where I had had the great good fortune to sit next to Owen Chadwick, one of the Regius professors at Cambridge. And I had greatly enjoyed this. I had come across Owen Chadwick's Victorian Church myself, but I came back and, as Fred says, he was always very interested in everything that was going on, and I said I was sitting next to Owen Chadwick. And I found, you see, he'd read all Owen Chadwick's books, knew them in detail, found them interesting, said how significant this outstanding book of Chadwick's is on the secularization of thought in the 19th century. He'd read it. He knew it. All these interesting thinkers of the day, he read them. As I say, biography itself. And he believed in reading widely, and he gave his reasons. He said, it will be good for your mind, he said. It will preserve resilience and freshness. I have always tried to do this and to take certain journals which deal with general affairs and literary matters and where there are good, well-written articles and I underline it, good book reviews, which will suggest other books for reading. Now, I've been talking to Mr. Sayre about this. You see, here's the Evangelical Library. He read all the book reviews, didn't he? And he phoned up and said, now I've read a good review here. How about this book? He read the reviews. They not only made him enjoy his own reading and give him further ideas, but you see, they enabled him to join enthusiastically in other people's reading as well. And he was really great here. This is another thing I miss. He used to give books for birthdays, for Christmas, for the end of a holiday, or the beginning of a holiday. Any occasion where he could give a book, he would, and he used to love doing it, and it was always the book that you would like, because he knew the kind of thing that we liked, and then he would read his reviews and think, ah, yes, now that would be a good one. He'd keep an eye on contemporary literature for Anne. Knowing my fondness for Victorian books, religious tract society books, Mr. Sayre is very helpful to me here as well in the Evangelical Library, people like Hesber Stretton, the other ones that wrote these Christian-based books. He knew I enjoyed them. And so what was my joy one Christmas, you see, to receive a book that I'd never even heard of called The Religion of the Heart, a book that considers all these writers and deals with them and gives further suggestions for reading and so on. Somebody we once knew was thinking of doing a PhD theology thesis. He'd got a subject. My father produced him a reading list that long. He read his reviews, he knew the kind of books, he'd read half of them himself, but at least he knew the field in which the man moved. And in a way, even more remarkable, I think, was his extraordinary series of pieces of advice to our daughter, to Bethan, who was doing a very esoteric thesis on a very particular sort of literary subject of language in poetry and so on, people like Edward Thomas and the old early Welsh poets, these old bards and so on. And he said to her, you know, along this line you're discussing, he said, there are some interesting developments in Cambridge at the moment. This was about 3-4 years ago. He said, you see, there are these structuralist fellows in Cambridge, he said. There's going to be some sort of problem there, I think. They're obviously, their writings are beginning to clash. Well, of course, 2 years later, the whole balloon blew up in Cambridge, and it had all, but he'd seen it coming. He would say, there's a book you should read by Frank Kermode, exactly along your line, he would say. Or, I read a poem by one of your tutors, Tom Paulin, in the Times Literary Supplement this week. I mean, not only in general knowledge, but in specific little details of research, he would know what was going on, and as a result was able to help us to enjoy what we were reading. He was a tremendous enthusiast. And he enjoyed sharing with other people's enthusiasms as well, with the grandchildren. You see, he would enjoy discussing the finer points of a wrestler with Adam, or school problems with the two older girls, or American politics with Jonathan. And in fact, I remember myself when I was a very little girl, I used to collect cigarette cards. Now, as you can imagine, it was rather a hard job for me to collect cigarette cards because nobody anywhere smoked around me. There were very few members of the church in Aberavon that smoked either. And I really labored my way through a collection of film stars in cigarette cards. I can't remember if it was Wills or Players. Anyhow, by cadging from my friends, by borrowing from school friends, fathers, all devious means, I got them all except Norma Shearer. And Norma Shearer hung over me for weeks. I couldn't get her. I kept on getting all these ordinary ones like Errol Flynn and all these others, but not Norma Shearer. I can't remember what number she was even, and I was getting depressed about this. I suppose I was about 7 or 8. These cigarette cards collections are now selling for anything up to £100. But anyhow, as I say, there it was. I couldn't get her. And then one morning, I remembered it to this day, I got up, and there at my breakfast place, on my plate, was Norma Shearer. And my excitement was tremendous. And apparently what had happened was my father had been preaching somewhere up the valleys. And somebody who'd been driving him, they always had tea. Oh, goodness, I'd look back at these times, these marvelous teas that there were between the afternoon and the evening meeting. You'd go to somebody's house, the table groaning with food, and there would be talk, and the ministers would be there. They were great days. However, on this particular occasion, the man who'd been driving him pulled out a packet of cigarettes. Pulled a cigarette out. My father leaned across the table and said, "Excuse me, have you got a card in that bag?" Somewhat surprised, the man said, "Well, I'll have a look." Pulled it out. "Yes, I have," he said. So my father said, "Can I see it?" "Good," he said. "It's Norma Shearer. I keep it." Now, you see what I mean. I'm now off my point, aren't I? But it was part of his, it's part of the thing that made him such a great reader. He joined in with it all. That was why it was so, ministers have said so often how much they loved him coming to preach for them. He'd join in with the enthusiasms and everything. And it didn't matter what it was, whether you were reading great tomes of philosophy or whatever, or whether you were a little girl collecting cigarette cards, he'd join in with you. And he would enjoy it with you. And your pleasure was as much to him as his own pleasure in finding it. Then, and this is very significant of him as a reader, he believed, of course, in relaxation. Now, on the whole, if people do a lot of reading, people say, well, you know, when you get tired, go out and have a walk or play a game of tennis or watch television or something. Not my father. He has a sentence which I think is very revealing. He says, "The mind must be given relief and rested. But to relieve your mind does not mean that you stop reading. You read something different." Now, this is what he did also. He read for relaxation. And the funny thing about this, and it's something that often used to amuse my mother, his real relaxing reading was his medical journals. He read medicine, as Fred says, right to the end. He enjoyed them. And they were often you'd find him in the evening reading them. And as I say, he sometimes read them to the most marvelous effect. He didn't just read them to relax, he took them in. Again, he masticated his medical reading as well. And sometimes it was invaluable. He would have read of something in some medical magazine somewhere that was just the answer that somebody somewhere needed. And so he read for relaxation. He also read apologetic works, of course. Now, really, where can I start here? I was talking to the Reverend Howard Jones the other day, and he said that he thought the great thing about him was that he was always about 10 years ahead of everybody else in his reading. And I think there's a lot in this. I've read with great interest this last week in the Welsh Evangelical Movement magazine, the Kilchgrawn, a review and an excellent review by by a man called René Laurentin on Catholic charismatics. The Welsh Review is a very interesting one, and I wholeheartedly support what he says. But the interesting thing is, now this is appearing in June 1982. My father got a number of us reading this book, I think at the beginning of 1978. In other words, he read that he was aware and kept himself aware of the general thought of the world. You see, I'm slightly moving on now. We come from literature and so on. He had read Hans Küng long before anybody else had ever heard of Hans Küng. He knew what Hans Küng was saying. He could see this problem. Not only could he see the problem arising in the English faculty in Cambridge, but he could see the philosophical and the theological developments of the world. And he was slightly amused at the sort of wild rush that a lot of speakers had to do to get hold of a copy of Hans Küng, to read him, because they didn't know him. He had read him, and he had understood him, and saw how the man's thought was going and the problems that were going to arise. Again, to quote my mother, she said that he often used to say to her that he felt that when you read general reading like this, philosophy, as I say, and general religious thought, he always wanted to know the other man's point of view better than he knows it himself. I illustrated that, didn't I, with Jonathan and that transcendental meditation man. Not only that, he used to say, you must read all these books, and he used to do it himself, and because he read them so thoroughly, he always advised us, didn't he, and I'm sure you all remember this, to be quite certain what a man didn't say as much as what he did. So often, you know, one would read and get taken over by a writer and say, my goodness, he says A, B, C, D, E. Yes, he would say, but he doesn't say F, G, H, I, J. In other words, you're missing what he's not saying. So all these philosophical books he read, and he read all the journals, they all came pouring into the house, the theological journals of every shade and color would arrive in the house. He would read them, and as I say, reading these reviews, he'd have ideas for his own reading. Not only that, he felt that it was important for us all as Christians to know what was going on in the world around us. One of the last books he gave Fred and me was a book by this man, Harry Blamire. I'm sure some of you have read him. He said, read this man. He's an interesting man. See what his position is, where he stands with regard to us, how close he comes and yet how far away he is, and so on. He enjoyed this kind of reading. But he said, too, that one always needed to be careful about one's general reading. It's the same point as I was making earlier. General reading is good, but it must never take over. You must know yourself, he would say. If you find you're spending too much time on reading something, stop it and balance it back again. He believed in balance. And not only was he balanced himself, as I said already, he was helpful to others. He said, you have to know what to read for yourself and also for others. And he certainly did. It's interesting to me, always looking back historically, the last 30-odd years, what a help he was to those of us who read literature back in the 40s and 50s. You see, this was the time before the whole arts thing had taken over in the Christian world, before Dr. Schafer's books had begun to come out, and the help that Dr. Schafer's books have to give. I was reading English at Oxford at the time, and I remember quite well getting myself into terrible trouble by attacking Chaucer for writing some story that I felt dirty old man. I didn't quite, but I very nearly did. And, of course, the wrath of the tutor came upon my head. And I remember telling my father this, rather thinking that I'd been suffering as a Christian, as it were. Not at all, he said. You're not handling your literature properly. He believed in this balance. You looked at literature as literature. And as a Christian, he helped you to handle it, to see what the style did, what the content was, what the purpose of the man was in writing it. I learned far more from him than from the tutor, how to handle literature itself. And he was very good at giving the right book to the right person. He tempered the wind, of course, to the shorn lamb. He has a marvelous passage, hasn't he, in Preaching and Preachers, where he says, if somebody is introspective and slightly given to depression, you do not give them a book that is thundering out the message of conviction of sin and the total depravity of man and so on. Otherwise, he said, you will drive him mad. He knew his people. He knew how to help them. As I say, from literature students through, as Fred says, to souls who were suffering, there was always something that he could find. And now I must quickly do the last three things, the reading he loved best. I've left this till the end, but of course, in a way, this is what you know even better than I do, a lot of you. I know this certainly as well as I do. He read theology. A preacher, he said, should continue to read theology as long as he is alive. But it must be biblical theology. He didn't like this arid reading and discussion of theology, where you tossed one doctrine around from one to the other. It had to be theology that arose out of the Word of God. This was theology at its greatest to him. And when he read a book of theology, again, he could see what the man didn't say. I remember when he was in hospital, having some very unpleasant treatment. For the whole of 1 hour, when the treatment was really at its worst, he sat talking to us about a person that's having a great vogue at the moment in the States, this marvelous new evangelical theologian. He said, "You need to watch his writings. He's not quite right," he said. In other words, his theology was so great, it was so much a part of him that he could almost feel what other people were saying. Then there was his devotional reading. I use this word carefully. Because he said at one point, "I abominate," he said, and it's a very strong word, "I abominate devotional commentaries. I do not want other people to do my devotions for me." He didn't like a sort of sentimental devotionalism at all. What he meant by something devotional was a type of reading, he said, which will help you in general to understand and enjoy the scriptures. He had a lot of people in this. The Puritans, he said, "You will find, I think, in general, that the Puritans are invariably helpful." He told the story of how when he himself was at a low ebb, how the heavenly Dr. Sibbs, do you remember, had helped him by the bruised reed and the soul's conflict. This heavenly pastoral figure had given him great blessing. He knew that some of them, like John Owen, were the greater theologians, but he said, that was his expression about it. And then, of course, how often have we heard him say, "I am an 18th century man," Jonathan Edwards. He kept on saying to us, "You must read Jonathan Edwards. In the middle of your political lives and your traveling around, read Jonathan Edwards," he said. "He is the one that can keep you with your feet solidly based on the rock. Read him and learn from him." Then, it's interesting too how, do you remember how in the Thanksgiving service, Gaius Davis and Mr. Romilly Jenkins had a kind of slight debate about my father as a human being, whether he was essentially a doctor or essentially a preacher. Do you remember the discussion they had almost? Now, not speaking about the greatness of the calling at all, I'm speaking now about him as a personality and as a temperament. We in the family think probably that both were right. But there is one other thing that one must add, and that is that he was a Welshman. Now, this was a very important part of him. Surprising how many people were surprised that it was in Wales that he was buried. He couldn't have been buried anywhere else. He was a Welshman through and through. He loved the other nations, sometimes with a sardonic smile. But he was a Welshman, and at the very end, he only read two things. Now, one of those things was his book of Welsh hymns. I'm sorry that so many of you are so deprived that I can't read some of them to you. These men, you see, these transcendental, in the right way, poets, with their marvelous imagery, their great grasp of doctrine, the wonder of their love for God, the tenderness of their application of the gospel message to the soul. He loved them. And as I say at the end, it was that book, was the one of the two that was by his side. Always a Welshman. Then, of course, he loved church history and biography. Now, this is so obvious that I really needn't go on. You all know this. What was the Westminster Conference doing? What was he always telling us to do but to read church history and biography? He loved it for itself. Again, it had to be a detailed biography. None of these potted things. That's why he always enjoyed big ones, like, you know, Mr. Dalymore's book on Whitfield, or, you know, some of the earlier ones with their great concentration of detail and so on. He also felt, I think, that reading biography provided a balance. He said the best way of checking any tendency to pride, pride in your preaching or in anything else that you may do or may be, is to read on Sunday nights the biography of some great saint. And all I want to do really is to illustrate this by two short stories. First of all, this reading on Sunday night. The beginning of 1954, he was reading through D.E. Jenkins' Life of Thomas Charles. Some of you probably know it. Big tomes again. And for several weeks in January and February, he would read bits of this aloud to us on Sunday evenings as we were going around getting the supper and so on. He'd be sitting there in the chair reading bits aloud. And in these two particular months, Thomas Charles was having terrible trouble with the lady whom he subsequently married. I don't know how many of you have read it, but she dithered for ages. She would come right up to the point, and then she would suddenly become afraid of launching upon the troubled seas of matrimony. Back Thomas Charles would go again into a depression. On and on, week after week, this went with the letters. He loved the letters, didn't he, in biographies, going back and forth. And in the end, one glorious Sunday night, she said, yes. And I assure you, we were all really rejoicing in this. In fact, if I am to be very honest, I have to confess that the Sunday night before Fred and I were due to be married, he was reading bits out of Thomas Charles, I actually found myself thinking to myself, oh, bother, I won't be here next Sunday night. You see, so great was his enthusiasm that it had got hold of us all, really. That was one story. The other story was a marvelous occasion when we climbed up to see the great memorial to the Covenanters, the communion stones. I don't know how many of you have been there. It's just up in the hills behind Hoyk. You know the great story of the Covenanters, how they used to have to go and have their communions up in the hills in case they were caught. We had a dire journey up there. We had to go through fields full of bulls. We had to leap over ditches, climb under barbed wire, but we got there. And we got to this really lyrically beautiful spot in a sort of amphitheater of the hills. And there's a great monument there, a high monument, and on the top is a communion cup. It's a wonderful monument to these great men of God, the Covenanters. And my chief memory is of my father, we arrived there, standing, looking at this thing, and taking off his hat. You see, he not only loved them, he was not only enthusiastic about these great men of God, he revered them as brothers in the gospel. They meant so much to him. And that I felt that was indicative of exactly how he felt about them. And then last of all, of course, the Bible. I've left this until the very end because you all know it. He said, read it, he said, because it is the bread of life, the manna for your soul's nourishment and well-being. You all know, I'm sure, that he followed the Murray McChain system of reading. He believed in reading the Bible often, from beginning to end, through and through, not just reading one's favorite passages. You studied certain passages when you needed them, but you read the Bible consistently, time and time again. I think Mother worked out that they must have done the system for at least 53 or 54 years. So, you see, the New Testament he would have read at least 110 times on the system, let alone all his own study for his sermons. And it's a remarkable fact to me, he died on March the 1st. On February the 28th, the last chapter of the daily reading he would have read was 1 Corinthians 15. It was as if the Lord, yes, he'd stopped taking the times. And the Lord was pointing him on to the resurrection of the body that was to come. It was this great systematic reading he did. I've been rereading recently some of the very early sermons he preached in Aberavon. You see, he read his Bible regularly. He knew it and he loved it. At the very end, when he couldn't speak, he would point to verses out of it. He pointed and to the one about in all things to be content, not to be anxious. He pointed me to the one about, you know, this earthly house of our tabernacle, the far better reward that was waiting for him. He just pointed to them, or he tried to write them down on a piece of paper. It was the Bible, the Welsh hymns, and the Bible. And as I say, one of his early sermons in Aberavon said this, on your own deathbed, he was about 28 at the time, you will be confident in the love of God and the knowledge which you have that Christ has died for you and your sins, and that you shall be with him in the world to come. Now, he proved that. You see, that was true of him because great, enthusiastic, wide-ranging, fascinated reader that he was. As far as he was concerned, the only fact in the whole world that mattered was the truth to which the Word of God, his greatest reading, pointed him to. The old, old story of Jesus and his love. And to finish, I really would like to read you a passage out of this little book, The Force of Truth. I think it really expresses the kind of way that we all saw my father at the very end. This is written by the Reverend John Scott, who wrote about Thomas Scott, and this is what he said. In the concluding years of his life, he was, as it appeared to me, obviously ripening for heaven. He had fought a good fight. He had finished his course. He had kept the faith. So that at the last, his genuine humility before God, his joy in Christ Jesus, his holy zeal for the diffusion of the gospel, his tender affection to his family and all around him, his resignation to the will of his heavenly Father, and his exclusive trust in the merits and grace of his Saviour, seemed to leave little more to be done but for the stroke of death to bring him to his grave in a full age, like as a shock of corn cometh in its season.
We do hope that you've been helped by the preaching of Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones. All of the sermons contained within the MLJ Trust audio library are now available for free download. You may share the sermons or broadcast them. However, because of international copyright, please be advised that we are asking first that these sermons never be offered for sale by a third party. And second, that these sermons will not be edited in any way for length or to use as audio clips. You can find our contact information on our website at mljtrust.org. That's mljtrust.org.